thank you very much. Yeah, you know, it's great to be here this afternoon. And you know, I taught school for 16 years. One of the things you didn't want to have to do is have that first class after lunch and keep everybody awake. But you know, I think you had enough energy, food, and you're ready to go. I just want to talk to you a little bit about my background. You know, I know you're thinking, why in the world have they got an old ex-politician up here talking? And we want to sell diesel fuel. And so sometimes we could sell a lot of hot air or gas, but I don't know about diesel fuel. But I just want to kind of take you through a path of where I came from and some of the guiding principles that I had and we helped develop and how you really come out of that and appreciate and experience what success is. You know, I started out not a lot different from what you guys are doing. I was on a feed truck. My dad was a Ralston Purina dealer. I was kind of amused at watching the beginning here and showing how, you know, we started from the old tractors, the old gas-fired tractors. Actually, the founder, we were Ralston Purina dealers. The founder of Ralston Purina, a guy was named William H. Danforth. And he actually started feeding horse feed, making horse feed down in St. Louis, Missouri. His theory was if you feed the horses, they got to pull the plows and pull the wagons and do that. And so you needed to have a good fuel, basically. And basically when the tractor and the combustion agent kind of put him out of the horse feed business, but he diversified. But, you know, I grew up in a feed store in Aurora, Illinois. And we were right on Ogden Avenue, Route 34, which kind of came in from the west, kind of brought in a lot of traffic from northern Illinois and certainly across from Iowa. And my dad could stand on the porch of that feed store on a Sunday night and tell you what the cattle market was going to be the next morning. Basically, the feed business was based off of the stockyards in Chicago, because every farmer. Back then, you had 40 head of cattle, because that's basically what we went in a stock car. And you had a couple hundred head of hogs, maybe. And your wife had, you know, 100 chickens or 150 chickens, and off the egg money kind of had the cash that kept your family going. But that was what the family farm was. If you're lucky, in the late 1940s, you traded your H off for an M, and maybe you had a hired hand on your 160 acres, but if you had enough kids, you didn't have to have the hired hand. And basically, in this area and north, those counties grew probably more corn than any per mile in the country. Good quality corn, but we imported corn because we fed so much cattle and hogs. And what happened when I was in high school, there was an economic happen. I'm going to come back to that for a minute. But you know, I'll go on the basis of, in politics, everything that happens politically has an economic consequence. And everything that happens in the economy certainly has a political consequence. I think you've seen that back and forth in the last 5 or 6 years, a lot of reaction because of cost of fuel, low unemployment, high unemployment, you know, escalating costs, food costs, all these things are happening and it affects you. It affects how you do business. I learned when I was 9 years old, basically a lesson in economics. My dad, we had a chicken house, an old brooder house, and you know, we were farm in a farm service business. But you know, if you were a farm dealer back then, you picked up a lot of the runt hogs and fed them out, and you had I had 4-H calves, and we had 1,000 layers, and kind of made the life go for our family. But he gave me we had a brooder house that was empty, so he put 25 chickens and hens in it, and he said, you know, this is your allowance. And you got to take care of these chickens in the morning at night. You got to water them. You got to feed them. And incidentally, you got to go in there twice a day and pick those eggs up. And now, a 9-year-old kid, you knew that you had to go into that chicken house, look at that chicken in the eye, and put your hand in that nest. And you knew you were going to get pecked. And, you know, bring that egg out, wash it, candle it, and your mom would take it to the market. And that's what your allowance would be. So you learn the values of economics, that you have to really put in something to get something back out. And I think that was one of the best lessons that I got. And I've always been a big advocate. I was in 4-H and went through the process and president of the county federation. But I always thought, you know, in 4-H is one of the first places I really had a mentor, somebody who took me aside and said, you can do this, and you really need to change what you're doing here, but you can be better. And I think that's what mentoring, I'm talking about all through my life. There was always somebody who stepped up and became a mentor. And I thought that was important, and I tried to do the same thing. But I'm going to talk about that a little bit later, too. But, you know, you talk about economic consequences. When I was in high school, I had a great career. I played high school football. I coached. I was a line coach. We had a small school. The line coach got promoted to be a superintendent or a principal of a school. So our coach came by and said, you know, you're going to be the line coach. I'm going to be the back coach. And so I had my first experience of coaching when I was a senior in high school. But we were a school of about 300 kids, Oswego, Illinois. It's a lot bigger now. But we were undefeated, our sophomore, junior, and senior year. So that was a great experience. And you learned a lot about competition. But I learned a lot from that coach. And that coach was another mentor of mine because he actually showed me that I could do some things that I never really thought I could do. And so I think being challenged when you're a young person, but being challenged any time in your life is really something that develops your personality and develops, I guess, the what you would call the will to compete or the will to win. That economic thing that happened when I was a senior in high school is, I don't know if we call it economic or it was really political, but for some reason, there's a lot of pressure to close down the stockyards in Chicago. And they did. And so, you know, we had you had Armour and you had Swift and you had Hormel and all the big packers were in Chicago. But the packing business started to move to the west. Iowa beef, Nebraska, Colorado, Montfort. And so that's where the packing started moving. So when the stockyards moved out, all of a sudden those people that had 40 head of cattle and 150 head of hogs didn't have them anymore. And so our business disappeared. We didn't have a feed business. And during that period of time, I had an uncle that was in a restaurant business, and he started out as a poultry market in Aurora, Illinois, and felt that it was a good segue from the poultry market to be in the chicken food business. So he was the first one to go in that business. Of course, the poultry market kind of was going out of style too, but he did it. And my dad started getting that business, and all of a sudden the stockyards closed, and we found ourselves in the food business. And I was a freshman in college, but I also found out I had to work my way through college. So I cooked three nights a week all the way through college. And but there's this happenstance of economics. The feed business disappeared, and all of a sudden you found yourself a small family business. You were in a different business. You're in a restaurant business. So those things happen in your lives. I went on to college. I played college ball. I played in a small college. It was college ball. There's no scholarship, so you basically got your scholarship and athletic supporters in sweat socks. And but it was fun. I learned a lot, and I wrestled all the way through college. And I found that those people who you learned and you trusted and you depended on, a lot of them came out of those teams that you played with. And especially the wrestling team, because there's nothing like wrestling. And you're going to have a great treat tomorrow when Dan Gable's here. Dan Gable, if you don't know about him, he's an Olympic wrestler. He was undefeated except for one match in his three-year college career at Iowa State. Great competitor, very intense person. And you'll find that intensity and that drive and that message that he has tomorrow. But, you know, that was part of wrestling. Those people who even my best friends today were people that I had in my high school and college wrestling team. It goes back again to the coach. It was the mentor, the person who put this together. I was lucky also in college to have a college coach who was a mentor and kind of helped me along. Wheaton was a pretty good academic school. I worked three nights a week and worked weekends. And so probably some of those weekends and nights I should have been in the library. So I needed a little help getting through college, but he helped. And gave me the push and the shove and the discipline when I needed it. You know, I thought that I was an economics major, and I thought the whole world was driven by economics, supply and demand, diminishing returns, all those things, microeconomics, macroeconomics. Matter of fact, somebody asked me, you know, I taught economics, incidentally, and people asked me, what was the toughest thing you ever did? And I said, well, probably teaching a class of sophomores at 2:00 in the afternoon, the basics of economics. You know, microeconomics, macroeconomics, supply and demand, diminishing return, all those things. And it's 2:00 in the afternoon, and they're either thinking about what they're going to do when they get out of school, what they're going to do on a date that night or what they're going to do, you know, but not what economics was about. And I thought that was the toughest thing to really get them into. I put them in what we call today a simulation game. But we make them, put them in business and gave them a business to run. It was all on cards and paper, and I didn't have computers back then, but you know, I think they got it. But I always thought that was the toughest thing I had to do until I got to Congress. I had to teach some members of Congress the basics of economics, so they didn't have it. And it was really a great challenge. But, you know, I guess whatever you do in your life, you never stop teaching. I taught for 16 years, a little school. You know, I was married, had a couple kids. I taught economics. I taught history. I taught sociology. I taught both U.S. and world history. I taught a speech class. I taught a business law class. You just teaching all the time. I coached two sports, and I drove the school bus to make ends meet. And finally, we were successful in wrestling. A couple things that I want to talk about coaching wrestling a little bit, but we were state champions in 1976. Now, I know that's long before some of you guys were even around, but 76, we were in the top 10 from 1974 until 1980, top five, six of those years in the state of Illinois. That was good for a small school, Yorkville, Illinois. We were about 350, maybe four kids at the later end of that. And we really had some great teams. But coaching kids and doing those things really taught you a lot of life lessons, I think. And, you know, I always thought of something about coaching that you know, you see these people swoop into the Sugar Bowl or the Rose Bowl or, you know, a Big Ten game at basketball. You think, wow, look at these, got all those great athletes, and all you have to do is get those athletes together, and you win. But, you know, winning is something that takes a long time. Winning takes a lot of practice. It takes, in sports, even in high school, it takes recruiting. You got to walk the halls, sometimes convince kids that don't think that they're athletes to convince them that they are athletes. Some kids who think they are athletes, and they also have to teach them they have to be students. And so you are a constant mentor, so you really go out and recruit these kids. I remember the first three or four years I coached, I had a hard time putting a team together. And but you just worked at it and worked at it. You built that credibility. You began to want to get, if you had success, and success breeds success. So one of the things I did is I wanted our team to be a little bit different. Iowa State, a team that Dan Gable wrestled for, wore these big robes. And I thought, boy, that'd be neat. We were red and white. Colors, and get these big white robes, and we'll put a black belt on them and red trim, and a big, you know, fleece was big back then, and we'd do that, and, you know, we started to win some tournaments and wore those robes, and all of a sudden the little kids, the kids who were third and fourth and fifth and sixth grade, they wanted to be wrestlers. They wanted to wear those robes, but not just wearing the robes. They wanted to be successful, and that robe was a symbol of success. And so, you know, it takes a long time. You just don't go out and win the big match. You never go into a contest unprepared. And sometimes that preparation takes years. Sometimes in Congress, to pass a piece of legislation, it takes decades to get done. So focus. You constantly have to focus on what you do. The discipline, not only yourself as a coach, but bring discipline to a team, because a team can't be a team unless there's discipline. You need to work patience and courage. You have to teach, you know, to teach a little kid who's 95 pounds, never done anything combative in his life, to go out on a mat under a big spotlight and compete. You have to teach that. You have to give that. You have to develop that in him. So you have to teach what courage is about. And you have to also diligence and just being there. Listen, you know, another thing about wrestling, you have to, some kids have to cut weight to make the team. If you're a small school and you got to fill 12 or 14 weight classes and you got more 145-pounders than anything else, just a natural selection, some of them have to, you know, lose weight and some of them have to gain weight. Mothers don't understand that. And so, you know, just the diligence of training and teaching mothers and showing that your kids are going to be safe and talking to them and building up that confidence and trust. And I think the thing that underlies leadership always, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit more, is trust. If you don't have trust, You can't take that truck into a farmer's yard and pump gas into his tanks. If you don't have trust, you can't put a team on a mat and expect them to do something extraordinary. If you don't have trust, you can't run for a public office and have people vote for you. So trust is the underlying thing of everything we do, especially in a society that's not regulated, in a society that gives people freedom of choice. They choose because they trust people. They choose because there's an underlying trust that if I put that FS product in my tractor, or I buy, you know, the gold label that you're selling out here, that I put that in a tractor, it's going to be a better thing. It's a trust thing. And that's something that really underlines what we do, no matter what we're doing. You know, another thing is, I think, is you never underestimate your opponent, whether you're in athletics or business or politics. You know, you think, yeah, we've done pretty good last couple elections. We haven't had much of a problem. And, you know, those guys, I don't have to raise much money out there to run my campaign because my opponents have been weak. That's not what you want to do. You never know what the unintended consequences of something is. And you never know what your opponent. You know, that BP guy that runs that tank truck around, he's not as aggressive as I am. He doesn't have a good product, or he doesn't have as good a prices as I have. And, you know, he just hasn't built the rapport up around. I don't have to worry about him. Don't think that. Because something can happen. That competitor can have a better product than you have, maybe. Or at least you can convince people, get their trust that he has a better product. So, you know, you constantly have to be working. Even at those people that you think you've convinced, those people that you were a good customer. I remember when I was a kid, you know, I got to be 17 or 18 years old. My dad started getting in the restaurant business, and I basically ran the feed business. And, you know, my dad had been calling on customers for 20 years. Farm families and, you know, fathers and sons and grandfathers, and you go down the line. And when I started to bring the feed in, and my dad was running a restaurant, and the guy said, well, you know, where's your dad? Well, he's busy. You know, and all of a sudden, you started to lose that customer because that I was just a kid. But those relationships were built on people relationships. They expected when that truck rolled in the yard, they knew who was going to be in the truck. And there's a trust there, and that trust is developed over a long period of time. So you can never disregard or underestimate your opponent, especially in athletics. And, you know, one of the things that I always thought I see happen time and time again is, oh, you know, that other team's going to get knocked off in a tournament because they have to hit this team and that team. Look, that's never going to happen because you never can tell what's going to happen in a tournament. You never know what the next round's going to be. And I find so many times kids, especially in wrestling in a tournament, this is a tournament time right now. Matter of fact, state tournament was last weekend. And you say, gee, this kid's up in this next bracket, and I can't wait to get to him. Well, you better worry about the bracket in front of you. You got to watch the match in front of you every time. So the challenge that's in front of you today, you can't overlook that challenge to be at the next challenge, that next level, or what you're going to do, or who's on the other side of the bracket. And with how you're going to handle getting them. You got to beat the first opponent first and the second opponent second. Getting the finals, great. But one match at a time, one round at a time, and one challenge at a time. And it's getting that first order from that farmer that you stop by and you talk to him and you talk to his wife and you know the kids, and you never get that order.
Oh, but, I seen the M real quick.
Anyway. What was that? But anyway, you never get that order. And, you know, you have to be out there day in and day out because someday he's going to give you that order. And when you get that order, you got to be ready to fulfill it and you got to keep that trust, but you build that trust. You know, another thing in politics especially, but I think it's anything you do, if you're going to drive that truck through the country roads across Iowa or Wisconsin or Illinois or Ontario, wherever you happen to be, knowledge is power. And in politics, knowledge is certainly power because if you know more than anybody else, and let me give an example. I came out of the Illinois legislature. I spent 6 years in the legislature. I had a great time. I I was just kind of riding the right wave, and I ended up being on the finance committee, helped put through the farmland a tax bill that gave farmers a break on property taxes. And then that was my freshman year. We had a majority. Next year, we had a governor, but we didn't have a majority the next term. But I ended up on the appropriations committee. And so I put in zero-based budgeting. And these directors would come in and scratch your head, what's that? Well, they soon found out. You had to build your budget. And by doing that, you were forcing them to learn, and you were forcing yourself to learn. And all of a sudden, people started to come to you to get answers. And then I was on a commission called the Sunset Commission. And the Sunset Commission was something kind of old. And, you know, you were whether you're going to renew horseshoe shoers licenses, you know, whether you needed to do that, or barber's licenses, or which guys, the old guy that did the witch for witch drilling or which whatever it was, find wells, that was a license. You know, you need that or not? And so we did away with licenses, and then new things came in. But one of the things that happened is the Public Utility Act that was written in 1927 by a guy named Sam Insull, who started Commonwealth Edison. He was the last guy to basically put that act together, and he did it from the commercial side. Well, the act was falling apart. It was done. It had a sunset. And at that was a time when we were building nuclear plants in Illinois. We had seven built and seven coming online. And nuclear energy was supposed to be too cheap to meter. It's supposed to be, you know, we were supposed to build one of those plants for $400 or $500 million. And after Three Mile Island, the actual cost of those plants were about $4 billion. Well, Commonwealth Edison, they were happy with that because they were a regulated industry. They got a 10% return on their capital. And you know, if their capital was $4 billion, great. That's a lot better than $500 million. So they sat back. They didn't care what the cost was. But the consumers cared what the cost was. The farmers cared what the cost was. And so we tried to look at different ways of doing it. So you built that knowledge, and all of a sudden people came to you. And you found you were in a very powerful position when you understood how things worked and how you could make things change. We went into a whole situation on what excess capacity. If you had excess capacity, you didn't get paid for it. You only got paid for it until it came into play, which was an equitable way to look at that. Also, at the same time, there was something called the Judge Green decision. A guy from Plainfield, Illinois, a guy named Jack Gokin, sue AT&T. Now, AT&T was world powerful, especially in the United States. Every time you had a telephone, with a few exceptions, it was AT&T. If you wanted a telephone, you lived 70 miles out in the country, you called up AT&T. If there wasn't a wire there, they'll run a wire out there. They'll hook up your house to the telephone line. They'll put it in a telephone. It might be a party line, but you got a phone and you got it hooked up for nothing, just to put you on the end of the line. It was called universal service. Well, this guy named Jack Gokin thought that you should be able to bypass, if you were selling long distance, why should businesses, just because they were businesses, pay more for long distance than what Aunt Sarah, 70 miles out in the country, was paying for that telephone, because universal service kept a low rate. They wanted everybody on the line. Well, the suit went into a federal court, came down as a Judge Green decision, said you had to break up AT&T. Now, yeah, you know, I got all these. They made me take all these things off or shut them off. But I got, you know, I got this phone here. I carry this. I got another phone. They call it BlackBerry. I finally learned it wasn't a blueberry or a strawberry. It was a BlackBerry. You know, and I also have an iPod that I carry around. And I feel like, you know, I'm the Starbucks or somebody. But anyway. That never existed. In 1984, there were no personal computers. There were no handheld telephones. You didn't have BlackBerries. There were no, because the system was a regulated, closed system. When you open up the competition, things happen. And I'll tell you, in this business, when you open up the competition, things happen. It's a great opportunity. But you are the competitors. You just have to do a better job. You have to have more trust. You have to have a better product. You have to go out and tell people. You have to make those stops, you know, at those farms that you pass up. You thought, well, I'll never get that business. So that's what it's all about. You know, one of the other things I always said when I was a coach, people said, well, you know, how's your team? You're going to win the state next year? You know, so I always said, gee, I'm going to lose my 38-pounder and my 54-pounder went off to college and da-da-da, and you know, tell them, and I don't know, we may be just so-so. I'd rather tell them that and then not tell them I'm going to win the state championship, but then come back and win the conference and win the districts and win the sectionals, and looks like you've really done something. So, you know, never brag, over-brag of what your product is. Let the product test itself. Let your team test itself. And I kind of, one of the things, even in Congress, I said, look, we're better off under-promising and over-producing. And I think that's a good logic to have. We're always better if we under-promise and over-produce. One of the things that people don't like is to be promised something that never happens, and especially in politics. So if you can promise what you think you can do and be logical about it and then do a better job than that, that was always kind of a logo. That was kind of a mantra for me. And I think we carried it in the 8 years that I was speaker. Incidentally, I became speaker kind of by accident. You're watching part of that accident happen right now. Newt Gingrich was the speaker. And Newt Gingrich became in a majority in 1994. I became the chief deputy whip. And Gingrich was a speaker. He really believed that pushing the impeachment of Bill Clinton would help our party. A lot of us didn't believe that, but he believed that controversy. Well, American people didn't like the controversy. They didn't like turning on their TV from July 1998 to December 1998 and seeing the Monica Lewinsky and all this stuff going on. And we lost six seats. We thought we were going to gain eight seats. We lost six seats, partly because of that. And as a result, a lot of the members of Congress, Republicans, weren't going to vote for Gingrich. And so I was the chief deputy whip. I had to make that call. And so I told Newt on a morning about 3 days after the election, look, I did a call around our members, and you're 12 to 18 votes down. And he said, well, we can make them. We can hold them to the caucus. We can make them vote. And I said, maybe you think you can, but you better talk to those people, because I don't think they're going to do it. Now, when you're talking about leadership in the Congress, any other office except Speaker just has to be a majority of your party. But Speaker has to be a majority of the whole Congress. So if he loses 17 or 12 or 18 people off our party lists, then he couldn't get elected. And so 2 o'clock in the afternoon that day, he made an announcement that he wasn't running for Speaker. He was retiring. And a guy named Bob Livingston, who was the head of the appropriations, he kind of stepped up and said, I'm going to be Speaker. Now, he had the power to do it. As a matter of fact, a lot of people thought maybe he was kind of ceded the power to get those people to be recalcitrant in the first place and said they wouldn't vote for Newt. Never know. Politics is a business that you always want to watch your back. But, you know, who knows how all that happened. But anyway, this guy, Bob Livingston from New Orleans, became the nominee designate for our party to become Speaker. And it so happened that the guy that ran one of these rag magazines put out a reward. And they could find anything on a Republican that was not some type of a problem that he had, a moral or whatever problem, somebody, they'd pay him $1 million. Well, sure enough, some lady in New Orleans raised her hand and collected $1 million and indicated it's a sin to say that in Peoria, Bob Livingston as a problem, and he stepped down. But we didn't know he was going to step down. So it was the morning. I'll never forget that morning. It was December 19th, 1998, and it was the impeachment trial of Bill Clinton. And I remember getting up. I had this little townhouse in Southwest Washington and thinking to myself, you know, I taught history and I taught economics, but in history you teach about things. I taught it after the Civil War, how Andrew Johnson, who was Lincoln's vice president and then became president after the assassination, how he had just a terrible time with the Reconstruction and actually stood for impeachment, and how it really changed the presidency. And I'm thinking to myself, how will this change our politics after this vote on the floor? Well, little did I know, Bob Livingston got up on the floor, said, Bill Clinton, you ought to resign, and just to put my money where my mouth is, I'm going to resign too. And you could have heard a pin drop. Now, Dick Armey, who was the majority leader, had get 4 ballots to get elected majority leader, so his credibility was a little shaky. Tom DeLay had some of the same problems. He was the whip that Newt had. And going down the line, everybody else. And John Boehner, who happened to be the conference chairman at that time got voted out by a guy named J.C. Watts from Oklahoma. And so Boehner was kind of out. And so all of a sudden people turned to me and said, you're going to be the next speaker. You know, I kind of looked up and said, why me, Lord? But anyway, it happened. And it happened because there was a trust issue. I was chief deputy whip. I had to touch everybody every day and find out how they're going to vote. And, you know, people don't necessarily want to tell somebody how they're going to vote. But you know, if we're going to bring a bill to the floor, you really have to know how people are going to vote. And because you can't bring it unless you have the votes. So I, you know, build up those relationships, build that trust up. I knew what their kids' names were. I knew where their what their wife's names were. I didn't go so far as the girlfriends. But anyway, you know, you knew where they hung out. You knew where they were in the cloakroom. You knew everything. And so you build up this trust. And I stood on the floor, and they'd come in, and the House podium would be here. The houses could be kind of a big semicircle. Most of the Republicans and older Republicans would come in the floor right here, and they'd ask me, what's this vote about? What's this amendment? I'd be there. I'd have that information. Knowledge is power. And so you build up that trust. So that day when Bob Livingston stepped down, people turned around to me and said, you're going to be the next speaker. They kind of called me the accidental speaker. And in a sense, I really was. I never intended to be speaker. I never ran for speaker. I never planned it. And that day that I walked into the House floor, I never dreamed that was going to happen. But it happens. And, you know, life is like that. Sometimes these things just happen. And it's how you react and how you survive is really what the story is all about. I think, is that time that I'm supposed to stop? Anyway, I'm used to talking in the dark. But anyway, voices from heaven, talking in the dark, you know, all those things. So anyway, I went through that, you know, and I always said the first bit of time was like drinking water out of a fire hose. It just, everything was coming at you. And, you know, we had the shootings in Colorado, the school shootings in Colorado right after I took office. We had a war in Kosovo, and we had a vote on the floor about going to war. That was pretty hairy. And all those things that happened. And then, you know, we had an election. And we had a downturn. You had the gas scandal up in down in Texas, the Enron issue, and you know, there were a lot of stockholders, employers got left short on their investments. You had the whole explosion of the high-tech stocks. You know, people put in $1,000 and they thought in 3 months they're going to get $3,000 back. All that kind of just blew up. And we were short $250 billion just in capital gains tax alone. And I'll never forget, it was the first year George Bush was there. It was the 10th day of September in 2001. And I went to Washington early to talk to the president on Monday afternoon and talked to him. We needed to get some economists in. We needed to get more confidence in our capital investment. Help our people with the dividends that, you know, really, so people invested. So we got a vitality of our markets going. And so I was in the Capitol early that next morning. And it was happened to be September 11th, 9/11. But I'm coming back and talking about that a little bit because I think that had a profound change. Now, everybody has a change in their life. A change in what they thought was going to go forward and what they were doing. But we're facing changes every day. And I think in your business, in energy business, we see a lot of changes. I get this little BlackBerry. I get all the news on this BlackBerry. I get all the energy news because I kind of stay on top of energy. Just today, you know, all of a sudden we have an agreement that Shell Oil is going to look for gas and oil in the Arctic Ocean. You know, so that's a step forward. And we're ahead of an agreement with Mexico yesterday. And so we're in a joint session. We're going to go and a joint agreement. We're going to start exploring and extracting about 1.5 million square miles of the Gulf of Mexico, which we have borders with Mexico, that we're going to start to look for oil and extract oil and gas there. And, you know, the whole pipeline issue and being able to bring a pipeline down to Canada, so that, or from Canada, the Keystone Pipeline, so that we have a ready supply of fuel. It's interesting. You know, energy drives this country. Energy is what makes this country work. And unless you have a long and a sure supply of energy, You don't build the industries. You don't have the trust in farming that next year is going to be as good as this year unless you can have a guaranteed supply of energy. I remember, and you guys remember too, because you were driving the trucks a couple of years ago when a unit of natural gas was up around 13 or 14 gallons or bucks a unit. You know, it was tough to sell that. It was tough to go to the house and knock on the door and hand the bill to the lady that writes the check. You know, farmers were really hurting and whatnot, and you couldn't dry your corn. You didn't know what the price of putting your equipment out in the field was. You didn't know what the price of your fertilizers were going to be. So because so much of our fertilizer is based off of petroleum, you didn't. We saw a lot of our fertilizer production move offshore to places like Russia and the middle European countries that could get at 95 cents a unit instead of $14 a unit. So we saw jobs and industries move offshore. We saw the chemical industry in this country almost go upside down because of the cost of natural gas. So the cost of these energy products and having them and being able to produce them and having a friendly neighbor to the north be our supply chain instead of somebody in the Gulf of Hormuz where they have to take these big ships through hostile areas and try to do and have an energy policy and dealing with people in places like Nigeria and Libya and on and on and on and Venezuela that aren't necessarily our friends. So we need to build that. We need to do more of that. We need to have a line of energy and so that we compete, not compete just with you can compete, but we can compete in the world. So our farmers can compete with our products, their corn products and soybeans, so the cost of energy in producing those products don't get so high that their margin is gone and they can't produce. So this is important, and this is important issues that are going on in Congress right now that we need to stay on top of it. And, I'm going to be part of, I can put a partisan hat on. I said I could do that for 15 seconds. I'm going to put a partisan hat on. This president who believes everything is based off of a footprint of CO2, which I believe we need to reduce CO2, we need to be more green, but when we don't have any more nuclear energy because he kiboshed that, we can't put our waste at Yucca Mountain, and you can't have any more hydroelectricity because we don't want to, salmon have to be able to jump over these rocks and get upstream, and we don't want to do any of these other things. We're not going to do any more coal, shutting down coal plants. We have to develop our energy. We have to develop the fracking that's going on. We have to do the tar sands. We have to be able to do all these things that all of a sudden, because of necessity, we found new ways to do it. But we have to drive those new ways. We have to make sure they happen. And that happens at the ballot box as well as it does in the economic box. So this is all part of something we have to get excited about and talk about and pursue. But I want to go back and talk a little bit about being speaker. And something that changed from a peacetime speaker, because I was really kind of a healthcare guy. And I always tell you the unintended consequences. I wanted to get on energy and commerce because I did all this stuff in the Illinois legislature. And a guy named Ed Madigan from Lincoln, Illinois was kind of the major, one of the senior guys on energy and commerce. And I went to Ed, I said, Ed, I want to be on the energy committee and I want to be on telecom. He said, well, I can get you on energy, but I can't get you on telecom because too many senior members on the committee are on it and you can't get on it. I said, wow, I don't know what I'm going to do. He said, well, why don't you get on the healthcare committee? Because I have to deal with this guy named Henry Waxman every week. He's a real pain, and I need to have somebody help me. And I said, Ed, I don't know anything about healthcare. I've never done anything in healthcare. He says, well, I'll tell you what, I'll be your mentor. I said, I can't have a better deal than that. So I took that committee knowing that Ed Madigan was going to be my mentor. 3 weeks later, Ed Madigan was Secretary of Agriculture. And I'm here all by myself. What did I do? I wrote a bill. I didn't know anything about healthcare, but I figured the only way you learn is to jump in. You can't swim, but you better jump in that pool and learn how. And we did. We wrote a bill. I had a couple of colleagues, one from Arizona, one from Florida. It was interesting. They wanted to do with senior issues, old age issues, so we did a long-term care. One of the guys that told me, a guy named Porter Goss, who had Southwest Florida, I said, what do you do mostly down in your district down there in Fort Myers? And he said, well, mostly we export cadavers. But anyway, not much you can do about health care about that. But anyway, you know, long-term care was an important issue. And so, you know, we really worked on that. And I had the cost of insurance for small businesses, because the insurance costs were driving. Part of that was the cost of insurance for doctors. So I worked on that side of it. And I created another issue was being able to go out and buy health insurance, and you make the purchases instead of just somebody telling you what that health insurance is going to be, and it's part of your job. Giving people the ability to go out and market and buy and use the free market called health savings accounts. It took me 12 years to finally get those things done. But, you know, I learned more about healthcare than anybody else. Bob Michael from right here in Peoria made me the point guy on healthcare after 2 or 3 years, and that really opened doors for a lot of other things, a part of this trust thing that happened. And so I want to go back to that morning of 9/11, the time that I went from a speaker that was worrying about education and transportation and energy issues and healthcare issues and making sure that we had a good, safe country, to all of a sudden a wartime speaker. I was in my office earlier that morning, had a meeting, knock on my door, "Mr. Speaker, something happened in a World Trade Tower. Either a small plane or a helicopter went in the airplane went into the World Trade Tower, and you better come upstairs." So I came upstairs just in time to see the second plane go into World Trade Tower. And I thought, well, this is not an accident. This is really a terrorist act, and we don't know who or why or what. But it was kind of an interesting day in Congress, because we had the Prime Minister of Australia that was going to do a joint session of Congress that morning. You have a joint session of Congress, you have the House and you have the Senate, you have the Supreme Court, you have the President's Cabinet. The President was in Florida, but you had the Vice President there. And, you know, the diplomatic corps, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, everybody is in one room. I think, whoa, this might not be a good idea. And so I tried to call Vice President Cheney. And I knew that he was down at the White House, and tried to get his heads up. And I'm thinking, we better close down Congress, but he's part of this joint session. I better get an okay from him. And I couldn't get a hold of any. It was too early for getting a hold of any Senate. They weren't there yet. But so as I'm getting a hold of Cheney, I have this white phone on my desk. And my desk sits in the front of the Capitol. Have you ever seen it? I think it's a $20 bill. My wife gives me one of those every once in a while. But anyway, the view of that, looking at it, has this great portico in front of it, and that was where my office was. And so I'm standing here looking down at the mall and picking up this white phone, trying to get a hold of Cheney, and you have to put a key in and a code, and Cheney has to do the same thing, and evidently two 65-year-old guys aren't doing the right thing at the right time, and I can't get through. So I got a red phone, ironically, on my desk where all my calls come through, and I get this little red light that lights up when it rings, no sound. And I look at the red lights going on. They got Cheney on that line. So I pick the phone up. And all of a sudden, this guy says, "What in the world are you guys doing up in Capitol Hill? The taxes are too high, and, you know, we don't like the way things are going in the military." On and on. I said, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, who's this?" He said, "Never mind who this is. Who in the hell is this?" I said, "I think you got the wrong number." And I hung up. And just as I looked up from hanging up, I see this black smoke kind of curling across the mall. Now, I can't see the Pentagon, but I can see the mall and see down the mall, and I can see the airplanes taking off from Washington National Airport. And I say to Sam that runs my office, "Sam, what happened?" He said, "I don't know, but I'll find out." A minute later, he comes back and said, "You know, a third plane just went into the Pentagon." And I'm thinking, we're sitting here, this big Capitol building. I'm right under this dome. We better close down. We got 5,000 people that work here. We have 500 members of Congress plus. We have interns and pages and employees and visitors and honored guests. We just need to make sure that we get people out of here. And so that, and I called the floor, and a guy named Porter Goss, who from Florida, is a guy that told me the story. But anyway, he later became head of the CIA. But I said, "Porter, we're going to close down, but I want to bring the chaplain on the floor to the House and say a prayer before we close down." I thought that was an appropriate thing to do. And I'm not thinking about timeline. And as I'm walking into the chamber, all of a sudden, two of my security guys, huge guys, grabbed me and kind of scooted me. I was a big guy, too. And scooted me out of the back of the Capitol, and I'm saying, "What's going on?" All of a sudden, we're in a tunnel going over the Rayburn Building, and I'm in put in the back end of a black SUV. And the Suburban's hurtling across the south side of Washington, heading for Andrews Air Force Base. And he said, well, we think there's a fourth plane heading for the Capitol. Well, actually, there was a fourth plane. It was a CIA plane that was kind of circling around, but people thought it was a fourth plane. They were panicked. I mean, I had a son who was working for vice president at the time, and they told him, get out of here. Just run. Go as far away from this building as you can. And everybody did. So there was this kind of panic going on. And so finally, I got to Andrews Air Force Base, and Cheney was on a line. And he said, look, we got four planes down. We think there's five planes. We think that we know there's two planes in New York, a plane in the Pentagon. We think there's a plane down in central Pennsylvania. We think there's a plane down in Kentucky. Well, the plane wasn't down in Kentucky, but the one in central Pennsylvania was. And he said, we're going to put you out in an undisclosed location. We have three planes coming over from the Atlantic Ocean. Their job, he and the Secretary of Defense, were getting all these planes down the ground, all these planes coming across from that are in the flying in the United States, both domestic and private. All these planes coming across the Atlantic Ocean from Europe had to get down, Nova Scotia, Goose Bay, all these other places to get them down. Planes coming from the Pacific to get them down someplace in the Pacific or Alaska or Canada or someplace. And he said, there's three planes coming across the Atlantic that don't have the transponders on and we can't communicate with them. There's one, a KAL flight coming across Canada that, you know, we can't communicate with that, and it's getting close. And we don't want to shoot these planes down. So that's his focus was. And he said, I'll talk to you when you get this quote-unquote undisclosed location. So we fly out, and we're in an undisclosed location. But I'm flying out, and we're going across southern part of Washington. There's nothing moving, nothing on the ground. Flying over Reagan International Airport, and you look down, there's nothing on the tarmacs, nothing moving. You look down the other side of the helicopter, and there was the Pentagon building. And this black, blue-black belching smoke just pouring out of the Pentagon building. And you're thinking to yourself, my God, I taught U.S. history about when the British invaded Washington and, you know, this terrible thing in 1814, the War of 1812. And we never have recovered from that. And, you know, British stole our mace and all that stuff. We're still suing them. But anyway, you know, I'm thinking, how will history change because of this? And I look out across the suburbs in northern Virginia, just the beautiful suburbs. It was a beautiful, crisp morning, but the whole suburbs were just covered in this blue-black haze all the way across northern Virginia. And I'm thinking to myself, my God, what's going to happen? And so I end up, spent the day out in this quote-unquote undisclosed location. And the other leadership kind of finally gets out there. Lott was the minority leader in the Senate. Daschle was the president of the Senate. And Dick Gebhardt was the minority leader in the House. And so we spent the day, basically got the news like everybody else. We watched CNN and other TV and watched the second tower go down and all the things that happened. And finally talked to the vice president and then the president. He was coming back into Washington on 6 o'clock, so our helicopters were going to come in and land at the Capitol at 6:30. We had a press conference. And it was over on the east front of the Capitol where the steps go down towards the visitor center in the Capitol. And as we walked around from the north side over to the east side, there was this steps, and there were maybe 150 or 200, 250 maybe, members of Congress, House members, Senate members, Democrats, Republicans, all on a step, and they kind of set it as a background. And Daschle and I were supposed to do, you know, just a press clip in 20 seconds apiece. So Daschle went out and gave his 20 seconds. I got up and basically tried to tell people that, look, this country's going to pull together. We got work to do tomorrow. We're going to be in work. The Congress is going to be in session. We're going to have to find an assessment and try to fix the problems. And I did that. As I turned around, somebody broke out in from the group of behind me, the members of Congress, into God Bless America. Just kind of a cappella just broke out. And everybody broke out into God Bless America. And I remember there was a chill just went right down my spine. And I think, you know, this country will be okay. We will stand shoulder to shoulder. We'll pull together and we'll get through this. And I remember talking to the president and saying, Mr. President, you need to come up and talk to the American people. And he did. And he said, well, you know, my staff wants to wait for a while and we find out who did it and all the... But I said, no, you need to come now. And he did. Within a week, he was in Congress. He gave one of the best speeches I think he gave before the Congress. But we did. And, you know, I whenever I went back and sat or in my office and looked out that window, I couldn't help but think, you know, all the great heroes we have in this country. We really do. The people that went up the tower, the policemen and the firemen, people who were the special first aid folks, people who serve in uniform, the Coast Guard and Marines and Navy and Air Force and Army, and did an extraordinary things. And we had a two-front war that we had to deal with. And you know, we had a lot of other things that we had to do. We had to get this country going again. For every night after, for 9 months after, we were in my office with all the Congress leadership, both Senate and House. We couldn't fly an airplane without getting terrorism insurance, and somebody had to underwrite it, and the federal government had to do it. We couldn't repair the buildings unless we had terrorism insurance, and that meant the AT&T building that was right next to the World Trade Tower, we had to get that fixed so you get the Wall Street markets up again. I mean, we didn't have markets. And so all these things that you never think about, we had to get going again. We probably had 9 weeks or 9 months of the most partisan, nonpartisan cooperation. And it was great until we had an election that came along and kind of went back in the old partisan way. But as I said, I never looked out that window. And I thought about the great heroes. But I also thought about that those folks on Flight 93. And I don't know if they were 7 of them or 10 or 14 or 11. We don't know. But we do know that they had radio phones on the thing. And they were calling back to their, because they knew they were hijacked. Their plane was turned around. And they were calling back to their loved ones and their family and their offices. And they found out what was going on in Washington and in New York. And they, just from sheer power, sheer decision to do something, went forward with a couple pots of water, scalding water from the coffee machine on the airplane, and the utensils from breakfast. They took down that Flight 93. They knew that that was their life. But they knew what those hijackers were going to do. And so some of those people overtook those five hijackers and brought the plane down. And at the time that I was making that decision and whether we should close down Congress or not close down Congress, if it wasn't for those folks, that plane would have been in the front door of the Congress of the United States. So I think about those people all the time. And, you know, we have great heroes in this country. We have really great people. And as I said, the ones that wear the uniform and ones that we can trust to do the job for us day in and day out. But we have great heroes that we don't know about. There's heroes sitting in this room someplace. That something happens, they're going to be there. There's some people sitting on an airplane someplace. They're going to be there and help you if you need help. So this is a great country. We have a great opportunity to be competitive, to know our products, to know our customers, to know the people that we serve, and really do the best job that we possibly can to be on top of the pile, to be the best competitors there are, whether you're in politics, whether you're in athletics, over there in your business. I created a great honor to speak to you today. Thank you much, and God bless you. Thank you.
What a wonderful story. Sentiments of leadership, discussion about how we can lead in our competitive forces as well. At this time, Chuck Spencer, Government Affairs Director for Growmark, will take your questions. Will help moderate a session here. Some of you have those note cards we talked about. You have Speaker Dennis Hastert here. You've heard a number of his, not only his discussions on leadership, but his experiences of coaching, as well as what the occurrences were and how he viewed 9/11, which was a firsthand perspective that all of us have memories of it, but none quite matching the intensity that he might have experienced in Washington, D.C. So at this time, I know that there are questions that have circulated out there. Do you have a question? We're going to have them. There's mics as well as people circulating right now with microphones to ask questions. Do you have any? Am I seeing any at this point in time? Chris, do you have any? Do you have a question? All right.
And is this on? Okay. It just to echo what Chuck was saying, if you got a question, just go ahead and pass it down to the end, and we'll take it, and we can ask it for you if you'd rather not get up in front of the group. But just you kind of alluded to it, Speaker, about the energy policy. And so maybe just looking over the next couple of years, the next 2-3 years, what's maybe some of the more critical things that we need to focus on as a country in order to address a comprehensive energy policy?
Well, basically, it's whether your basic source of energy. If we're going to be a dynamic, progressive, productive country, and I mean keep our industries here, not let our industries go offshore, we have to have our own source of energy at a reasonable price. When we depend on our source of energy coming through the Gulf of Hormuz, whether it comes from Iran or Iraq or Saudi Arabia or, you know, Nigeria or Venezuela, those aren't countries that we don't necessarily have the ability to trust. And, you know, things can change. And prices, you see our prices escalate up and down every time that there's a little political incident out there. We need to have our own source of energy. We have the ability today to have enough natural gas to last us for 100 years. We have the ability today to bring pipelines down and have the ability to refine our own oil and the refining capability. You know, we haven't really built a new refinery in this country for 25 years. We need to do it. And we need to be able to move some of this regulation that sits on our ability to be productive. And I tell you, this is going to be a waterfall or a election, or a watermark election. And, you know, because this president and the people who he has in the office, from president or from Secretary Chu, who is the Secretary of Energy, to a Secretary of the EPA, to a Secretary of Transportation, to a Secretary of just everything out there. And their thing is, look, we got to limit the energy that we have in this country. We got to make this country green. We got to take our money and help other countries that can't help themselves. I agreed in that part. But, you know, all of it's about limiting what we can do. And we need to change that. We need to be dynamic. We need to take the lid off. And there are clean ways. Natural gas is a lot cleaner than most other things. We need to use ethanol. I fought for ethanol from the time that I was in the Congress for 15 years and finally got through the Ways and Means Committee along with a guy named Nussel from Iowa, and we got ethanol as with the tax credits in it and so that it can be a viable product. Today, there are people that don't want to see ethanol out there. They don't want to see ethanol because it's competitive. And, you know, if we sit back and don't do anything, we're going to lose the ability to have ethanol. Ethanol today, you know, is one out of every four rows of corn that your farmers plant. It gives them the margin in their products so that they can make a profit. If you take that margin away, you can't make a profit farming. And they can, you know, they're not going to buy your products. So we need to work together. There needs to be a teamwork to make sure that these ideas are, and if you sit on your hands and say, we're going to let the next guy talk about it. But, you know, you have it. Most of you are a great, and I don't expect you to be big politicians. But, you know, you can, every time that you're in a farmyard, you can talk to your farmers about the importance of an energy policy and a good energy policy that's going to benefit farmers and benefit industry and business in this country. You know, that's part of the job of doing business. That's part of that trust thing I was talking about. Stop.
Does anybody else have questions?
I do have a question.
I do have one.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Yes, sir.
In all of your years serving in politics, and you just kind of talked about the energy policies and that, do you see a distinct difference the way people vote based on their geographic area that they come from?
Well, sure. I mean, look at everybody comes from someplace. I remember when I was in the Illinois General Assembly, there was a guy named Jim McPike, and he was from down, what they called down under, so like Granite City, just north of St. Louis, near Alton. That was his district. And he was against farmers. Every time we had a farm bill up, Jim McPike would come up and talk about the farmers and how the farmers were getting so much and they were taking all the tax money, on and on and on. My gosh, where did this guy come from? I mean, how can he talk like that and get elected? Until I took a train one time from Springfield to St. Louis and went through his district. And his district was full of old factories with broken windows and tumble-down towns, and that's where he came from. So everybody comes from someplace, and everybody's going to vote. You know, if you talk about one of the most upside-down turned upside down policies. There are dairy policy in this country. But you ever try to change dairy policy? I did. And you got to fight with farmers from New York and upstate Vermont and, you know, California and Wisconsin. And they all have their own little dairy policy, and nobody wants to change. But, you know, everything is adverse to actually real production. But, you know, that's the way it is. So everybody is from someplace, I've always said, in politics. So that someplace really kind of dictates how they're going to vote. And there's one other thing that's happened in the last couple of years. In the year 2000, there was a vote, a piece of legislation that came down called campaign finance reform. And a campaign said, we're going to take all the money out of the parties. And it was kind of a bone to John McCain, because John McCain was upset because he lost South Carolina in the 2000 primaries because the Republican Party put a lot of money in for George Bush. And so he was going to get even. It was the McCain-Feingold bill. And, of course, he got the New York Times to get for it. Most major big city newspapers were for it, editorialized for it. I couldn't keep my guys against away from it. And so we passed it. And it basically took all the money out of the parties and saying, we're going to, you know, you can't, if you're a national candidate, you can't put money in a state party. State party can't put money in your campaigns or work together. You had to be separated. And so that passed. And I went to the president and said, President, Mr. Bush, you ought to veto that bill. He said, well, let me think about it. One of his staffers said, oh, you can't veto it. It's good government. Well, what it did is push all the money out of the parties into the extreme wings. So the people who not are necessarily running for Congress, but people that fund them, are from the extreme right wing or the extreme left wing. I see this guy Adelson, who owns casinos in Las Vegas. He just put $11 million in Newt Gingrich's campaign, talking about putting $100 million. Well, when somebody from an extreme edge of the party, I know this guy, he's not a bad guy, but he's an extreme edge of the party. When he puts $100 million, you know, you can't put $100 million in. Your whole industry can't put $100 million in. So these people have adverse effects. So what you have is people from the far right and the far left funding our candidates today, and that drives a huge schism, I think, between trying to work across the aisle and get things done. That was kind of a play on to your question, but I'm sorry. Yes?
Got one additional question here, kind of piggybacking off what you've already just touched on, but how would you go about solving the current right versus left gotcha politics?
Well, basically, that's what it is. It's where the money is. And in politics, like sports and other things, you follow the money. And the money has moved to the far extremes, both in the Democrat Party and the Tea Party types. And I'm not down on them. They're there for a reason. But they are to the far right. And that's where the money is. And that's where the noise is. And that's where candidates are reacting to. And so it all of a sudden, politics is a gotcha game. And, you know, if you say something or do something or your kid does something, boy, you're smacked. And part of it is just, you know, we have cable TV that's on 24 hours a day, and I don't know how many channels of it. They have to have something to fill those airwaves. It's not like the old days when you had ABC and CBS and NBC, and, you know, you had news at 7 o'clock at night, and that was it. Today, people have to find news, and they find news everywhere. And sometimes you just get blasted with it.
You had mentioned trust and leadership probably 30 times during your talk. Do you feel like one of those is more important than the other?
I think leadership comes from trust. You can't have leadership without having trust. People won't put you in that position. Or if you are in that position and if you betray that trust, you won't be there very long. I don't care if you're the salesman driving an FS truck, or you're a coach of a Big Ten basketball team, or, you know, you're a wrestling coach, or you're the state representative someplace. If you don't have trust, you don't end up staying in office. If you don't have trust, you don't end up staying up and keeping your customers. If you don't have trust, you can't be up in front of and work that team.
So what are the major components of building trust that you've observed over your years?
I think steadfastness. I think being involved with people, talking to them. There's nothing, you know, you can put all kinds of paper out until you step in front of somebody and go eyeball to eyeball and talk to them and they know you as a person. That's what builds trust. It's you know, you can have all the fancy interconnects that you have and tweeters and everything else. But real trust comes from somebody standing in front of somebody and talking to them and building a relationship. So trust comes from relationships. I think the way I became Speaker of the House, not that I was planning on it, was a relationship. I had a relationship with every member of Congress because I talked to them every day, every time that they came to vote. They trusted what I had to say. They knew that I worked hard. And, you know, all these other things pull in. You have to work hard. You have to, you know, be diligent. You have to focus. You have to have a passion. I always said there was four P's to politics. Now, you know, you talk about trying to things, but, you know, the first P is you really have to have a purpose. In order to put your name on the line and put your family's reputation out there and everything, you have to have a purpose for it. And you really have to work that purpose. And then you have to have a passion to do it. Because you're not even going to work for, unless you're really down in your, we call it the fire in the belly. Unless you have really the fire in the belly to go out there, you know, to run for office is a terrible job. I mean, you've got to go to every chicken dinner and Lions Club and school board meeting and PTA and just state representative. You just everywhere all the time. And, you know, you're back home all the time. And my kids wouldn't go to the Walmart with me. Why? They didn't want to spend 2 hours for me to get a half a gallon of milk and a loaf of bread because I had to talk to everybody. You know, once you stop talking to people, once you don't do that, you begin to lose that trust. So trust is something that you constantly work on. And trust is also something you can't take for granted. Once you have it, you know, it's a fragile glass. I always say politics is a fickle business. Well, one thing will just crumble it. All the work, all the work that you've done to build those relationships, that can just go away with one misstep. So, you know, trust and leadership is a long, long walk. It's a long, long road. You just don't snap your fingers and be there. You have to build it. And it takes a long time. Sometimes you're building it unconsciously. And sometimes you're building it and the people you're talking to don't really realize you're building it. But it's an ongoing process. You're there because you have this relationship with your customer. You have a relationship with the people that you work with. If you're in politics, you have a relationship with your constituent, relationship with the members in your body, with your leadership, and you build that trust. Hopefully, don't shut the lights off on me again. It's been a great honor to be in with you. Thank you. God bless you.